Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Hello and welcome to Face Connecticut. I'm Morgan Cunningham on WTIC News Talk 1080, Light 100.5 WRCH and 96.5 TIC. Our guest this week is State House Speaker Matt Ritter, who's joining us to talk about the outcome of the 2026 legislative session, all kinds of topics pertaining to it. And we do this every year. It's good to have you on again, Speaker.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start off with your summary and your take on how this year's session went and wrapped up.
Yeah, I mean, look, everybody, I think, talks about the budget. That is the any legislature's main priority and main responsibility is going to be adopting a budget on a timely basis, and hopefully people like the budget you adopt. For me, to see a budget that was so overwhelmingly bipartisan and what is otherwise a very partisan profession these days, is a sign, I think, that we did some good things. Obviously, the highlight was the increase in educational cost-sharing grants for boards of education across the state. We did an additional $170 million plus. We also did a $100 million one-time property tax stabilization grant by giving money to towns. So we took care of some major issues in that regard. And we did all of this without touching any of our reserve funds, still making over $1 billion in supplemental pension payments to retire legacy costs that we've inherited from prior generations. I've always said it's important to do both. You can't put all of your eggs in the basket for the future. You need to help people today. I think this budget did a good job of balancing it.
And we're going to definitely talk about some aspects of the budget as we go through our conversation. I want to go all the way back to the very beginning of the legislative session. Governor Lamont outlined a number of his priorities, some of which shifted as the few months wore on. And one of those ideas he was advocating for was a $200 energy rebate. But ultimately, that idea was passed on. What happened with that?
I think that we determined that focusing on the property tax would be a better way to go about it. And the governor was flexible in those negotiations. So think about it. We sent to Hartford and Bridgeport, for an example, over $30 million in additional aid. Their boards of education were facing massive deficits. If we don't do that, they only have two options: massive cuts to their educational system, which I'm not sure how much more they can cut, quite frankly, or number two, raising the property tax. By sending this money to our municipalities, we've kept taxes either flat or much lower than they otherwise would have been. That's a much bigger benefit to a resident who owns a home than a $200 energy rebate. And it was something that the mayors and first selectmen and first selectwoman were pretty adamant about in our negotiations and conversations with them. So at the end of the day, that's how we're going to give property tax relief this year, or relief rather, is through the property tax.
You had mentioned schools and education. I was going to bring this up later, but kind of piggybacking off of what you said there, you know, that aid for schools, it seems every year there's this push to get more money for schools. Their needs go up, the deficits, they always seem to be in deficits from one year to another. Hartford, as you know, has been no secret, no stranger to those kinds of problems. You know, Senator Looney earlier on in the session had proposed a plan to reform the ECS funding, which is not had its base funding increased since 2013. There have been bonuses, if you will, added to it. You know, some additional aid this year, for instance, but not a funding change to the structure. There has been a panel created to study that further. The governor wanted a panel to study it. But how come no immediate reform on that?
Well, we did use the formula that people have been talking about and trying to increase the base amount. But I think that what this Blue Ribbon Commission is really going to have to focus is special education. The main increase that I think we're seeing for boards is the special education costs. And partly that's to better identification than perhaps people had 10, 20 years ago of knowing kids who might need interventions at an earlier end. Again, it's a very wide spectrum of what a special education cost could be. You have some children that are very, very limited, both physically and intellectually, and that can run $1 million a child, especially if there's an outplacement that has to happen, versus some kids who just need extra help, maybe reading or something like that, for a disability that they can still work through it. But that's really what's driving it. And so I think the governor's talked about that. I think if we're going to really look at ECS, I think we have to really look at special education. Otherwise, I'm not sure we're ever going to get to the point where we're really helping the municipalities the way they want to be helped, or the boards of education, rather.
And it doesn't seem like they seem to like the year-to-year stopgap funding, if you will, the bonuses. They appreciate it, but it doesn't allow them to plan further out, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's there's some accuracy to that. I mean, look, we've put a lot of money into ECS over the last 5 years. So I don't think the legislature can be accused of not providing adequate funding. I think the problem is the costs are much higher than people anticipated they would be. It's a tight labor market for teachers, so salary increases go up. Everything else is more expensive because of inflationary costs. And you add special education on top of that. I used to say, when I was in the city council in Hartford, we had a couple of situations where we had children that would cost $500,000 to $1 million because of these outplacements that had to occur. It always seemed like a morally bankrupt system to me. That child could live in Hartford, West Hartford, Newington, Bridgeport. And we sort of, as a state, have put it on the municipality where the individual child lives. And it is just as difficult for Hartford to budget for that as it is for a small town in eastern Connecticut that could struggle with the same thing. Those are the types of things I think the state has to step in and do a better job of helping and paying for. And I think those are the conversations we're going to have in the next 6 months with this Blue Ribbon Commission.
In April, there was word Eversource bills would be dropping, and as was there was word for UI that bills would drop as much as $34 per month for the average customer through next April, shifting topics here, Speaker. And there was also word of the public benefits charge credit that Governor Lamont championed through at least September of this year. But the Republicans who I spoke with recently have been critical that there's no longer-term change or reform to electric rates and electric billing in the state. Is this something that could be fixed for 2027, a longer-term plan?
Well, it's an election year, so you'll hear all kinds of wild promises and cannot be kept. The problem in Connecticut is, like much of New England, our issue is we need to have more supply of different type of energy, right? Whether that be solar, nuclear, which has gotten a lot of attention of late, natural gas, whatever it is, we need more of it. And we really are not able to, in isolation as a state, make substantial changes. Yes, people talk about the public benefit charges, and I understand that. And we've made some movement on that. And again, some of it's coming off the bills, and we have to be mindful of that and be more careful. But a lot of those charges are for programs that, frankly, that are important to be, for our future and sustainability. Again, solar is a prime example of that. So I don't have an easy answer. We're working on it. We're mindful of it. I know the New England governors just got together and talked about, what they're calling sort of small nuclear and looking at those options. But we have to continue to look at all things on the table, wind, solar, and we'll try to attack it. But we really are part of a regional market. We are tied away, we're all the way up into Maine, how we procure our energy. It's a complicated topic.
One issue that came up on the energy front that was not anticipated, even though there were some reports of chaos in Iran earlier this year, it was not expected that there was going to be a war between the U.S. and Iran. And one of the ideas that had come up was pausing the 25-cent gas tax that was proposed. That did not actually happen. And there's been debate at the federal level if the federal tax could be paused for a time. But I'm wondering if this were to continue for too much longer and the gas prices remain elevated and don't go down, could you foresee a special session on that issue?
I think the federal government is always better when they reduce taxes because then it affects everybody the same across the country. The problem with reducing the gas tax in Connecticut, it's about $30 million a month, and you can't ensure that it's only benefiting Connecticut residents. So if Connecticut did it and Massachusetts did not do it, nothing stops a driver from Springfield coming into Enfield to fill up their gas tanks. And Connecticut is subsidizing Massachusetts residents in that regard. You also have, there's no progressivity to it. A billionaire gets the same tax break in that scenario as somebody who's a teenager working, you know, working 20 hours a week to make ends meet. I'd rather be more targeted and send rebate checks to people to avoid that problem. They could use it for gas if they wanted to, but it the gas tax is a hard one because I don't think you get the same benefit you're looking for from a public policy standpoint when you do it. But it's not that I would vote no on it, but I think there's a more targeted way to give that same benefit to people.
I'm Morgan Cunningham, and this is Face Connecticut for those of you just joining us. And we're talking about some things that came up in the 2026 legislative session, some of the big issues and topics from earlier this year. My guest is State House Speaker Matt Ritter. The state took a bit of a defiant tone with a few bills that proved controversial this year that more or less send a message to Washington about how Connecticut will react to certain policies or changes within the federal government, and two bills that may come to mind, the so-called ICE and vaccine bills. Democrats have argued that these are legal under the 10th Amendment. Of course, they face criticism from the other side of the aisle. But with the threat of looming challenges, my question is this, Speaker, is it worth the cost and the scrutiny of any lawsuits and perhaps multiple challenges to those lawsuits concerning state power on federal issues? Or is that something that the Democrats are willing to accept and see play out in courts?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to separate them a little bit. Let's talk about the bill around ICE.
Okay.
There'll be a legal challenge on that one. If you look at what the bill provides, it just says that you got to wear a name tag, which every law enforcement agent in Connecticut wears and has a name tag. It says you can't cover yourself with a mask unless there's, there's certain exceptions for that. And it says that if you intentionally and willfully deprive someone of their civil rights, you can be sued personally. All things that apply to anyone else in law enforcement in the state of Connecticut at this point in time. So they can challenge it, but I think we have the right to say that there's a rational basis, both, you know, from a state right perspective to pass this law. We also say that ICE agents can't go into hospitals, churches, and schools. That's been the public policy of this country under Ronald Reagan, Barack Obama, and the George Bushes and Bill Clinton. Only the Trump administration changed that. I think it's worth our resources to defend it, and I know the Attorney General will if we get sued. But these are pretty common sense reforms. These are not radical in any way. And frankly, they were not a problem until the Trump administration made them a problem. With respect to vaccines, very different. I don't know that we'll get any legal challenges in what we did. We didn't add any vaccine mandates. So there's nothing new in the vaccine policies. What we did do, though, is we decoupled ourselves from the federal board that Robert Kennedy oversees because he's stacked with people who are not, in our opinion, following science. And we're going to tie ourselves to what the American Pediatricians Society and other doctor groups vote on. Other states have done this. I don't see any constitutional challenges or any merit to constitutional challenges in that regard.
Going back to the ICE matter for a moment, talking about the name tags and the masks, how can Connecticut patrol federal agents? That's been one of the questions that I have seen come up about that particular issue.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, they're federal agents, but when they're in the state of Connecticut and they are operating against residents of the state of Connecticut, can you have reasonable restrictions? The Attorney General has been very clear to say, Connecticut, you're right, states are not in charge of immigration policy. That is a federal policy. It would be illegal for the state of Connecticut to say, for example, that ICE can't come to Connecticut, right? We can't say that. ICE agents are allowed to enter the state of Connecticut. We can't tell them what crimes should lead people to be, detained versus not detained. That's federal policy. But we think that saying that you have to have a name tag and you got to stay out of schools, for example, we think we have the right to say that. That is not greatly impeding their federal authority nor their ability to do their jobs. It's just common sense restrictions.
Continuing
on. We'll see what a judge says. We'll see how it plays out, you know.
When that we will. Continuing on with some of the other issues, perhaps one of the other more controversial bills that came up in this short session this year, the homeschooling oversight bill. What's in that particular measure?
Yeah, so the homeschool bill is really just has two requirements, I would say. The first one is that individuals have to register on an annual basis, all parents of children with their local school system. So if you go to public school, private school, or you homeschool, there'll be an annual registration requirement, which surprisingly we don't have now. And that it actually happens in most schools because they make note of enrollment, but we'll just clean that up and make sure that it applies to everybody. And the second part is, if you withdraw your child from school, the schools will be authorized to check a DCF list to see if there are any open or active investigations that have been verified around anything around child abuse or things like that. And that's in response to some of the cases we've seen across the state where some parents remove children for the sole purpose of, quite frankly, abusing them. And we're going to do our best to put this one another tool in our toolbox to try to prevent it from happening. I acknowledge it will not maybe stop everybody, but it might help in some cases to prevent a child from being withdrawn with an active DCF case. It is shocking to me now that before this law was passed, and the governor still has to sign it, by the way, that you could withdraw your child even though you had an active DCF complaint. I think common sense would tell you that that's not a good mixture, perhaps. But I'd also point out that this is very few cases. This is not going to have an impact in any family that's providing a quality education for their child at home. It only impacts you if you have, DCF involvement, quite frankly.
What happened with the so-called portfolio requirement? There was some kind of a negotiation there that was ultimately removed from the originally proposed bill. What happened to that?
Well, you got to get votes for things, right? And so that was one of the things that got jettisoned during the negotiations. And it was a hard standard because it is a question of who would be determining if the portfolio met certain requirements, sort of a subjective criteria versus objective. The districts didn't want to do it. They didn't want to have someone be involved in it. So it kind of fell apart. And I think we, the chairs of the committee made the decision that, hey, let's do something. The DCF piece seemed to be the most critical and important, and you take the policy that you can get with the vote count that you can get.
Do you think that there will be an appetite at a later date to add that back in, or is this kind of a wait and see approach? Maybe.
Probably the latter. I think that there will always be the ability for any legislator to put any bill they want in, but I think the Education Committee will probably focus on other things in the next term, if I had to guess.
Also, talking about that homeschooling bill, the Republicans in particular have been critical of the Department of Children and Families. In the Senate, Republican leader Stephen Harding had quoted from a report, and he sent out a statement a few weeks ago on a report from the child advocate about a child who committed suicide after meeting with a DCF caseworker and wanted to get into foster care but couldn't. And I guess my basic question is, are there any other plans that could help reform the DCF agency itself, whether or not a homeschool child is involved?
Just on the DCF front, we did pass a bill, 5004. Representative Parris was a big part of that, our chairman of the Children's Committee in the House, to look at this. We now have an oversight committee of DCF. We're going to, create a portal to look at sort of our, how long cases are open, how they're being handled. Other states do it, like Wisconsin. So we're mindful of the issues that occur at DCF, to Senator Harding's point. But let me also note, it's a really hard job. There is a ton of turnover at DCF. These are emotionally taxing and grueling cases often. These folks are seeing things that are really, really difficult and hard. And for a lot of people, they can make more money doing something that is far easier and far less emotionally taxing on them when they go home at night. So it's a complicated situation, but we'll continue our work as a legislature to work with DCF and the commissioner and see how we can be better at getting people to stay so that there's more seniority and experience in staffing as opposed to a lot of turnover. And then B, what are best practices that other states have done for some difficult situations?
So kind of a long-term approach to figuring out that problem in to sum it up.
Yeah. I mean, look, the governor could be Rel, Roland, Lamont. Connecticut's DCF was under federal oversight for decades under Republican and Democratic governors. So it's a complicated thing. And I never like to make excuses, But it's not like if you changed parties and who ran the legislature tomorrow, DCF would not have its challenges. Of course they are. These are very difficult cases. Parents have rights, by the way. You can't just walk into someone's home because you get a phone call or a tip. There are, you know, you have to go to a judge. It's hard. And a lot of times these are young children. There's no way to verify. They're hidden from public and they only manifest themselves at really bad times. But has there been times when DCF has dropped the ball? Yes, there's no question about that.
Speaker, in our final few moments, I do want to point out that one of the giants of the Capitol, I think those are your words exactly, Senator Martin Looney, the Senate president, is retiring after 46 years at the state Capitol. You know, any final thoughts on Senator Looney and his work?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, his record is safe for me. No desire to spend 46 years. I say that obviously with love for Marty and what he has been a giant. And to think that somebody has basically dedicated, as he said, he grew up at the Capitol and grew old at the Capitol. It's remarkable. It's tough to be in public service. I don't care if you're on the local Board of Ed or the Senate president. And for anybody to do it for that long, as well as he did it, and same for Mary Mashinsky, the longtime rep from Wallingford, it really is amazing. It's amazing that people elected you all those times. You got to be pretty talented and pretty nice to continue to get elected. And there's a lot that happens. So I'm just happy that he got to leave on his own terms. We had a great send-off for him in the House, which has never happened before to our knowledge, where a Senate leader came down to be feted and recognized. He's a great man. He's been very good to me. And I know we'll stay in touch because I really appreciate his advice and counsel all the time.
One of the more enduring questions here, of course, you know, I took a look at all of the seats that are up for re-election, and I noticed that there were several dozen where at least one candidate had no opposition from the other side of the aisle. In some cases, there was nobody challenging anyone. And in Senator Looney's district, it was just him who was running. So I think to the bigger point of my question here is, how do we get more competitive government, more people running in the state?
Well, I mean, we do have bipartisan redistricting, which I remind people. So we're not like some states where the whoever's in charge can draw the lines the way they want to. It doesn't mean the maps are perfect, right? But obviously, in any state, you're going to have some seats, just like you have federally for Congress, that are just not competitive. You know, in Hartford, for example, right, I don't think I've seen a Republican get more than 15% in my entire career in a general election. It doesn't matter if it's a gubernatorial or presidential. If you go out to some parts of eastern Connecticut, there probably are Democrats who don't get more than 25% in any given election. So sometimes in certain districts, it's just hard to find people to run given the reality of the situation. And that is what it is. You're going to have areas that are very blue or very red and not very purple, no matter how you draw the map. That's going to be the reality.
How about that pizza bill? I've asked you this the last few years as kind of the final question. How about that?
Did it pass this year?
I don't believe so, no.
I don't think it came up either. I was going to say, I don't recall it coming up, although we did this year for our listeners. We did name the state bird is the robin. And in the month of March, the robin will now have company. We also said that Sue Bird, the former UConn legend and WNBA legend and U.S. Olympian legend, will also be the state bird in the month of March. So we didn't do pizza, but we did do Sue Bird.
Speaker, well, I always appreciate sitting down with you and getting your thoughts.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me again. I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Speaker.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Bye.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.